beginning of five sessions called Middle East Image and Witness. My name is Jonathan Ferrix, and today's session is called Middle East Hollywood Holy Land. And I'd like to know a little bit about who's here before we start. Has anybody here been to the Middle East? Could you just say, sort of shout out where you've been?
Israel.
Many parts.
Many parts.
Lived in Libya for many years.
Oh, do you want to come and teach us first? Lived in Libya. Great.
For 13 years.
Uh-huh.
Israel and Cyprus.
Cyprus.
Israel and Egypt.
Okay. Other people?
Jordan, Israel, and Egypt.
Would all of you say that you sort of follow the news a little bit and know some things about the region, you think?
Sure.
Let me say that if you're lost about anything I say or disagree about anything I say, please interrupt. I'll try to stop from time to time and encourage you to interrupt, but feel free to interrupt as we go. There won't be a set time to break up into small groups, so put your hand up at any time. Stop me from talking. Feel free to do that. And talk to your neighbor at a few points when we talk about that. May I just say, by way of introduction for myself, we also live in Cyprus, in Limassol. My family and I have been there for 2 years, and I work for the ELCA, Division for Global Mission, as a missionary. And I work with the Middle East Council of Churches as a producer and a co-producer and a consultant on really about documentaries about the Middle East and also coordinating some studios which the Middle East Council of Churches has in Cairo, in Beirut, and in Cyprus. And our session to this week, if I can just look over the week very briefly, is to speak about the image we have of the Middle East, to think about that together, to try to understand and examine our image of the region, to look at some of the consequences which that image brings to us and to our life and to our relations with that part of the world, and to look at some of the realities which are a little different from the image that we hold about the region. And I'm speaking not as a Middle East expert. There are too many of those around already. I'm speaking as somewhat experienced and overseas living person who has lived there now for 2 years and had his eyes and ears open and works in media. So take what I say with a grain of salt, and I hope it's clear the level at which I'm speaking. Today we'll concentrate on the images question, the very first part of it, some of the negative stereotypes we have about the region. But since not all of you will be here every day and some other people will come, let me say that the bottom line of this week for me is just to try to say, or to try to explain and have you perhaps agree that we have a real problem with the Middle East. We stand in danger of never knowing its people, of never knowing the Arabs, for example. And that it behooves us as Christians and as citizens of the world to do something a little better than that, I think. And one of the premises of our work is that the people who come and see change their opinions about the region. If they come and see more than one side of the many arguments that we know so much, or we think we know a fair bit about in that part of the region, they change their opinion. Their lives are changed by seeing more than one side of some of these arguments. So that's sort of the premise that we would like to meet. If we meet the Middle East person to person and get away from some of these images, our lives will be different, and it will affect our faith also as Christians. The images we look at today spread from Desert Storm to Merry Christmas and various things in between that. And I'd like to start by a little bit of associational thinking. Engage with me, please, in this. When I say Middle East, what's the first thing that comes, not even to your mind, but to your stomach, or to your heart, or to your gut? Maybe turn to the person on your right, or in pairs like this, and just say off the top of your head to each other, what comes to your mind? Now those who agreed with each other, who agreed with each other? Who said exactly the same thing? What did you say to each other?
Conflict.
Conflict, okay. Another group that agreed? Okay.
We have sand and desert, which was pretty close.
Sand and desert, that's pretty close. Other images. You had two good answers, a lot of you. What were they? Please.
War.
All right. Other images?
Camels.
Camels. That's a good one.
Flowing robes.
Robes?
Flowing robes, yeah, but long.
Others?
Sure.
Oil.
Oil? We saved that one for the bottom line, of course.
Turmoil.
Pardon?
Turmoil.
Can we, will you accept conflict? We can't put too many of those out there. We might get just so negative we won't be able to get anywhere today.
Poverty?
Okay. How about poverty and wealth?
Yeah.
I'm missing a couple that I think you probably said.
Intrigue?
Okay.
History,
that's a nice one.
Muslim?
Arabs.
Okay, Arabs. Muslims. If anybody said Christians, they can leave because they don't have anything to learn in this class. Did somebody say Christian? Okay, let's put it up there. Certainly, I'll put it in brackets because it's not, I think it's fair to say, it's not what comes to our minds, is it? But it's part of the reason that I'm there, for example. Where do you think you got these images?
News media.
Media?
Yeah.
Yeah. You think of any other places?
Movies.
School, entertainment media, news media, books.
Television.
Okay.
Travel.
Mostly sort of secondhand things, Sunday school. I think that's pretty clear for all of us. When we say Middle East, what do we mean? What countries do we mean?
Jordan.
Okay, you're
Kuwait, Iran, Iraq.
You all agree? What, would you agree to Algeria?
No.
Morocco?
No.
Iran?
No.
Turkey?
Not Turkey.
Yeah. Well, let me suggest that we've got a problem here. The term gets used for everything. We take the Mediterranean. You take the Mediterranean, it gets used for everything. We put the Italian boot here and the Turkish peninsula. It gets used for everything from Morocco to Iran, and including Turkey, and Sudan and Libya, northern Sudan, Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, those kind of places. It's a very, very broad term, and it isn't a very helpful term. And if you come tomorrow, we'll throw the term out. But today we'll leave it there because it's part of our image it's a question we can't solve, but part of what we have to think about in this little session is that to regionalize isn't very helpful, because this term can justifiably be used from Morocco to Iran, but we're talking about North Africa, which is certainly a different kettle of fish from Iraq, and the Iranians aren't even Arabs. The Turks aren't Arabs. There's a lot of other minorities sprinkled around there who aren't Arab. And we quickly run into trouble with this list when we look at what we're talking about with the term Middle East. So that's one grid that it doesn't pass through very, very well. But without throwing out the name today, what I would say is that what I'm going to be mostly talking about, and I'll use the words Middle East because it's a hard habit to break, but let's hope we break it sometime, is this area here. Egypt, Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, basically that group of people, and a bit of Turkey. And I'll do that because that's where the Christians are, by and large. Iran has to be included if I say that as well. But this part here that most of you probably think of as the heart of the Middle East is what we're really talking about today. I won't pretend to say anything. I don't know anything about North Africa. And I don't know very much about Saudi Arabia and some of those places. Don't have much experience at all in that direction. So think of that. Now, let's turn to the Gulf War for a minute, the thing that's on most of our minds still. And I'm going to ask you what your image of the region was in the Gulf War. Was it anything different than this? Did you learn anything during the Gulf War about the region? Yeah. People are saying yes. Please share what you...
A little bit of the history, the breaking up of the empire, Ottoman Empire, into the Sheikh, you know, like Iraq, Kuwait, okay. Saudi Arabia.
Right. Which didn't sort of really go very well with some of the arguments about the war, I think. I mean, the more some of the history came up, it was a little problematic where some of those boundaries were drawn.
Yeah.
And who was claiming which piece of oil and which piece of sand. Some of the other things?
Well, you could see why Kuwait was so important to Iraq and him as their passage to the sea.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think our occupying forces met the culture and had culture shock in a big way in terms of how they were expected to support themselves and the women weren't allowed to drive and various things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was anybody here over there? Or had a son or a daughter or a husband or... No? Okay. We got quite a balcony up there. I don't mean to ignore you.
We had a friend. They were pretty isolated away, you know, from the people themselves. They really had very little contact.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they were purposely isolated as well.
Mm-hmm.
Our people, our community has a steady stream of people going to that area of Jordan and Kuwait. Their engineers rebuilding things.
We had just arrived in the region in time for the war, and it wasn't clear to me, at least, how much was being learned about the region from the way we followed the war over there. It seemed like there were two air wars going on, the one by the U.S. Air Force and the other one by CNN. And we had the privilege of watching the one air war because our little Cyprus television channel switched over to CNN 24 hours a day to hear about the war from the one side. So it was a kind of a strong experience for us. And I, reading up about it from the media point of view, it seemed to me that the war said a lot more. We learned more about ourselves than we learned about the region. About our capacity for getting into something sort of on one side of the coin and putting up with an enormous amount from the media point of view of censorship and government control in an effort to do something different for Vietnam. We were in some kind of a swirl, I think, about how to do a war better than we did it last time. And the region was sort of ignored, I think, as far as I could tell from the kind of media that I saw in terms of the war coverage. Or it often fit into those categories, and there were instances of learning that those boundaries had a bit of a strange history when they were laid down there, and some of the states couldn't quite be described as simply as we might like to describe states. Yes, please.
We had many close friends who were in Saudi Arabia and in schools in Dubai, Egypt, all of whom were there continuously during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And schools were still functioning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The aspect which was troublesome out there in the field was the feeling that the region was somehow just a set for a movie. It was just a sort of a set for a war movie that was being brought home onto our screens, and the sense that to get anything out of such an involvement, you had to know the place so much better than it was being known by the powers that be in our country. So it was a pretty frustrating time from that point of view. And as I have spoken at churches and at global mission events of the ELCA and so on, in this month we've been back here, quite a number of people have come up to me and said how used they feel by the media and by the government at the time of the war, and their sense that there's a whole lot of people out there that weren't given the time of day in our coverage of that event. And I raise it because if you come on Wednesday, we'll talk about some of the consequences of the images, the bad images we have. And I think you can argue pretty strongly that if we had a better image of that region, we would never have allowed that war to happen in the manner that it did. Because we would have known that those were human beings who had some legitimate grievances with us and with each other that we could perhaps appreciate. But they had been pushed out of our brains to a certain extent, because we think mostly of sand and desert. You know, what does it matter if you do a war in a desert, Desert Storm? You know, look at the name itself. It's part of this sort of hype that we're used to and with which we usually cast off the region. And when we get around, how many of these things deal with people, the things we brought up? Not really. The Arabs and the Muslims do, but they're both sort of prejudicial, and not all Middle Easterners are Arabs by any means. And the term Arab is problematic too, because the real Arabs are the ones from Saudi Arabia, basically. Others are called Arabs all the way to Morocco because they speak Arabic. But if you want to be precise with your language, you should say Arabic-speaking peoples. But call an Egyptian an Arab, a certain kind of Egyptian, and he might, you know, tell you to go back to school and study some more, because he doesn't want to be thought of in that way. Arabs are the Saudis. You know, he's an Egyptian. He's one of the first civilizations on earth, a great country, all these kinds of things. So we're not, our imagery isn't real human oriented, and that already raises a warning sign for us, I think, as Christians, that something's going on perceptually with the region that we have to pay attention to. Another area that I want to look at images in, get away from the Gulf War, it'll come up a little bit in some other stuff that we look at in the course of the week, but I wanted to look at it under the heading of the church and of the Bible. And something interesting happened to me here. I was looking, I have a sheet that I picked up in Jerusalem last time I was there, and it's put out by the Christian Information Center, and it's sheets and sheets, actually, I just took the first page, of biblical references for visiting the holy places. So, for example, the first one is Jerusalem. There are 656 times that it's mentioned in the Bible, and you can sit there in Jerusalem and look them all up. The temple in the Old Testament, the temple in the New Testament, there's a quarter page on each of those. The Mount of Olives, etc., etc. And I looked at a fair few of these, and I found that our problems of imagery with the region are not coming from the Bible. This kind of stuff, it's not in the Bible. Our prejudices about those other cultures and so on are not really going to be found in the Bible. But I think it's a different story when we go to, for example, Sunday school, and when we go to Hollywood's portrayal of the Bible, then we start to get into the image business, which raises the topic at hand here. And an example of that to be perhaps considered, it's easier for us to consider it, is Christmas. When you say, what comes to mind when you talk about Christmas? What's the image that comes to your mind?
Manger.
Pardon?
The manger.
The manger? Okay. Bethlehem. What kind of a town is it? Sort of, is it cute?
Yeah.
Rustic,
quiet.
Rustic, if not cute, it's rustic, okay. Other things for Christmas? The Christmas we celebrate.
Shepherds in their fields.
Shepherds in the fields, yeah.
Santa
Claus, stars, presents.
Snow.
Snow, Christmas trees.
Poverty.
Excuse me?
Poverty.
That comes to your mind when we say Christmas?
Well, maybe. You've graduated already from this class, too.
Yeah.
D.C. didn't have a lot of presents there.
Right. Right. I want to come back to the Christmas side here from the people on the scene. Hollywood has had a go at telling us about the Bible and some of our pictures and some of the people throughout the world. I know Coptic Christians in Egypt who say to me that their picture of the Bible has been determined by Charlton Heston playing whoever he played, or by Liv Ullmann or whoever it was doing Jesus that time. And these images somehow we carry around with us. And they're not coming from the Middle East, they're coming from Hollywood. And I want to play for you, those of you who are here will have to turn your chairs a little bit, a few minutes of a tape that has been done by some Arab Americans, two Arab American people who decided that they would go through existing material, news, entertainment, and put together clips of the way that their region is portrayed in our media. Okay. You said Israel, you said Egypt. And I think it's worth saying that it's a big region, and I'm someone who likes the outdoors and places like Holden. And I've found in the Middle East already quite a few places sort of like Holden, mountains, pine trees, you know, places to go for a walk, amazing stuff. And I'm just dying for a way to get down to Yemen, where they have some of the most remarkable architecture in the world, and mountains and terraces on the sides of mountains, and a unique culture. Fantastic place to visit. And there's any number of places like that. Beirut's a bit torn up, but some of you heard about Lebanon before in the days of peace, and it had that sort of attraction too. But we think, in terms of tourism, we think of the Holy Land, and we think of Egyptian antiquities, and that's just about it. And look at them both. The Holy Land is an antique too. It's an antiquity. It's making antiquity out of a modern place with a different set of a different reality. It builds on the familiar. It builds on the sort of one-dimensional thing tourism does. And when you say one-dimensional, you start to think about images again. It tries to validate tourism so often in this part of the world. Just tries to sort of confirm for you your image of the region. So you get a ride on a camel, you maybe put on a headdress, you go to a Bedouin tent and drink tea with them. All of the stuff that we expect happens to us when we buy one of those package tours. And we even imitate sort of our image of what Hollywood told us it would be like when Jesus was there. We sort of want the place to look like it was when we saw it in the movies. And some of the places do. And some of those moments are great. But some other dimensions should be considered, because we're talking about something that's more important than yours and my holidays here. And it's a matter of life and death for many people over the years in the region, and still seems to be continuing that way. What you see that doesn't fit when you go there like that provides negative confirmation for you, really, of the image you have. And the example that comes to my mind, and I had the experience myself, is Cairo. If you've been to Cairo, it is a dirty city. And driving from the airport to downtown Cairo, I wasn't surprised at all. I knew it was going to be dirty, and it was dirty. It looked just like it had always looked in the documentaries and news reports. And I spent several days there feeling like this is a dirty city, a dirty, crowded city, and I don't really like it here very much. But I had another experience, which I should probably save for a session which isn't devoted to the bad things, which brought to me the people of Cairo, or some of the people of Cairo, and after really 5-6 days, the dirt didn't matter one single bit. There was a sewer puddle in front of our studio there, and it's always in front of our studio there because the sewage leaks, and you have to really tiptoe over rocks to get to this Middle East Council of Churches studio. But you didn't even notice it after a while. And it was a kind of a transformation to go through that when we would often be stopped by the dirt. Another example I think of is women in veils. I've got some articles about, written by women in veils, about a defense of that way of living, of that being private space, of that being a way for them to have their dignity. And there's some pretty interesting defense made of that. But I think from our level, When we see a woman in veil, especially if all you can see is this, or even the ones that have the whole thing covered, and you wonder how they can see through the cloth, it just confirms for us. We sort of say in our brains, see, look at those poor women. And we think of, if we maybe go to Israel and we can see some more modern types wearing less clothes, and it's a nice contrast with that. Or we think of the way women were in our Sunday school pictures, and they're much nicer than the ones in the black cloths. And so the negative thing, the things we see that don't fit with our stereotypes, with what we want to find there, tend to push us again in that same direction. Another thing that our image does in the tourism business is it puts us on the same interest level, on a convergence of interests with some people we may not really want to be in partnership with. And one is the tourist industry itself, I'm speaking of, when I say we, I mean Christians who are serious about the world. We may not want to necessarily do what the travel industry wants to have happen. And the interest of the travel industry is to sell you Egypt of antiquities and Israel of the Holy Lands. And Israel of a little bit more than the Holy Lands, Israel of the modern Israeli nation, which is so successful and dynamic and powerful and sort of our friend in the area. It also puts us very much, in the case of Israel, on the same interest level as the Israeli government to pursue policies that fit very well with them. We're supporting their lobby back here in the States, really, when we just go and see that kind of thing, when we follow that ad and do what those people did, harmless as it may seem. And we'll go more into that in later lessons. Something else that comes into us for us as church people, your minister often gets a free ticket. If six of you go, or eight of you go, or nine of you go, he gets a free ticket and he goes with you. And you go and see the Bible sites together, and you have wonderful moments trying to live out the Bible a little bit with each other when you get over there. His presence adds legitimacy to the trip for most of us, because we're being led around by our spiritual shepherd, our pastor, in these lands. So it has another overlay of legitimacy to us. And it's not bad of itself, but what does it leave out? It's promoting holy shrines. It's promoting holy sites. We partake of something like that. It's promoting also success. Because of the power in that land of the Holy Land today, your tour guide, although there are some Arabic tour guides, there are less and less of them, they don't get licenses anymore. It tends to be an Israeli, you tend to see Israeli success stories. And that becomes, again, part of the picture that we bring back. And we may not even notice what is going on around us, or we may notice. I've spoken with groups there in the occupied territories, and they say, hey, our guide isn't telling us anything about but what's going on around here, you know? Why are there all those soldiers on the streets? Why is all the houses painted with graffiti, political graffiti? People do ask questions and want to break out of it, but it seems to me that people also pretty much don't even have the time to get out of it, because they're given things that they're used to. They're given food that they're used to. They're given building projects and forests and things like that, which they relate to and which speak to them as people. And the other stuff is crowded out if it isn't actually shut out from your presence. I have a sense, in Jerusalem, for example, very strong sense of crossing over a line between the first world and the third world, or the two-thirds world. When you cross from the Israeli side of Jerusalem to the Arabic side of Jerusalem, you're crossing between two worlds. Two worlds are in a collision right there. And it used to be a no man's land, but the winning side is very successfully obliterating that no man's land, and they're turning it into a freeway, they're turning it into parks, they're turning it into housing. And they have islands of the first world now, successfully built up and very viable within this third world setting on the other side. And it's quite an experience to be with the Christians of the Middle East, in this case the Christians on the West Bank, that's where the Christians are, spending your time with them, working with them. And then one night I was out for a walk and I wanted to get a drink or something, and I went into the Hyatt Hotel, and it's built in terraces down the side of the Mount of Olives. And it's a beautiful building. It just sort of spills down the side of the hill. And it was like stepping into New York or Miami, just like that. On the street, about 150 feet away, I'd been in another country, another world. And just like that, I was back in something that was like Miami or New York. The accents, what the people were doing. There was a going home party going on around the pool, sort of a cocktail party around the pool of a group of Israeli Americans or American Israelis going home after their session there. This very strong sense that somehow reality is being stretched over to cover another, one reality is being stretched to cover another reality, and the imagery that we live with is part of that successful conquest, I think, of the other side. The tourism business also downplays very much the presence of Muslims, people that we don't know much about. You don't see them when you go to see the pyramids. You don't see them when you go to see the Holy Lands very much. And also of Christians, who are also in both of those countries, especially in Egypt. Egypt has up to 20% of its population, which is Christian. But how many of us ever get a look in on that when we go to see the pyramids or the Antiquities Museum? These kinds of things. And the Christians of the region, and I speak again especially of the Palestinian Christians, the ones in the West Bank, they see these hundreds of thousands and millions of Western tourists, many of whom they know are Christians, coming month after month, year after year, and paying no attention to them. And it seems to them that we Western Christians are somehow much more interested in the past and in dead stones, in ruins, than we are in them. And some of them get pretty uptight about this and angry, and they want to pound on the windows of the tour bus and say, hey, we're here too, we're Christians too. We've been here since Pentecost. You know, talk to us, relate to us. Others are getting a little tired of saying the same thing over and over again to the groups that do come and listen to them, and they don't see any change in the policies of the countries where they come from. The Christians, we're going to talk about more in depth tomorrow, but they think of themselves as living stones opposed to those dead stones, those ruined stones, and they want to say that they have fellowship to offer. They have a culture, a valid culture, a different culture from our own, which we can relate to, which we can have an encounter with. They want to perhaps explain or have us see that they also have a witness as Christians that isn't the same witness that we might think a Christian witness is, but it's a valid witness, it's a viable witness. They'd like us to hear a bit from that. And they would like to feel part of the world church, because in many cases they're a minority within a minority. They are Arabs in the West Bank, in Israel, together with the West Bank, if you take them as a group. Christians are a minority within the Arab population, and the Arab population is a minority within the whole society. So there's a tremendous pressure on them to be in a ghetto and to have a ghetto mentality. And people in ghettos like to be have contact, I think, with the outsider and would like to be considered and remembered and drawn into some of the things that we take for granted. But many of us go there and don't get the chance to even say hello to a living Christian because of the tour business, which goes very well with this imagery, as we saw right at the beginning there. I mentioned Christmas earlier and our images of Christmas, and I'd like to wrap up this session today on that note. We think of O Little Town of Bethlehem and shepherds washing their socks by night, watching their flocks by night, this kind of thing. There's a Lutheran pastor in a town next to Bethlehem, a town called Beit Jala. His name is Mitri Rahab, and when he is asked about this, he says to Western visitors who come and are talking with the Christians of the region, he says, well, Christmas for us is not a spectacle or a pageant, you know, a time of Christmas trees and presents and the wonderful star and all these things that, that we take out of the Bible story and which we add to, something which we enjoy. He says Christmas for us is a story that we see in different terms. We see a child that was born under occupation, that narrowly escaped a genocide, the killing of all the other babies Jesus' age when Herod tried to get rid of Jesus, narrowly escaped a massacre, had to flee as a refugee to Egypt, to another continent, where he passed the first years of his life, and had to live throughout the rest of his life with a fairly ruthless and oppressive government. That's the Christmas story that they read when they read Luke 2. And I think that we can appreciate, even though we haven't perhaps thought of it in those terms, that when the angels came and said, peace on earth, goodwill to men, that was a place where peace was needed. You know, that was a place where goodwill was sorely in deficit. It wasn't sort of a nice sounding chorus in good music that we enjoy at a Christmas concert, you know. These things get shifted subtly, I think, into nice zones of comfort and enjoyment of tradition and personal warmth and good family times. But somewhere along the line, we leave out the reality which is at the heart of the gospel message. Pastor Rahab says, it's not something out of this world. It's not an, you know, sort of a divine cosmic moment when the stars foretold the birth of God and it was all wonderful like this. It's down to earth. It's a proclamation from God, a caring and crying God to his oppressed people at that place, the place he chose to come. And remember that those oppressed people, 70 years later, were virtually wiped out of that place. They were thrown out. Jerusalem was destroyed and they were scattered. That's what bad times they were in. That's where that gospel message came to, and that's where Christ, God, became incarnate to speak to us about the nature of God and to be our real, our guide, and the leader, really, of our religion, of our faith, and our concept of God. So a Palestinian Christmas is that person coming under occupation, becoming a refugee, and choosing to live in those situations, situations which aren't so different from the reality of that part of the world today, the occupied territories, and for the Christians of the world today. And this is still good news, as much as it ever was, but we're not going to get it from Hollywood, and we're not going to get it from Holy Land thinking. We're going to get it from taking the Bible and leaving the images a little bit behind and holding the Bible up to reality with the people, in this case, who are living the reality on that spot. Now, we have a few minutes, and if you've had thoughts that you wanted to interject or questions, please make use of it. Yeah.
You said that most of the Christians, Palestinian Christians, live on the West Bank, right?
Right. It's about half and half now. There are Arab, Israeli, Palestinian Christians, you know. There are Christians in Israel, too, among the Arab Israelis, or Israeli Arabs, whatever you want to call those. There are 700,000 Israeli Arabs who didn't leave their homes in 67 or 48. But I think the total figure is about 110,000 Christians in Israel and the occupied territories. And they're about half and half. Where they come to mind in at the present time is mostly on the occupied territories with the struggle that they're having to make a peace settlement and get a country for themselves before it disappears from under their feet, you know. The other thing to mention about them is that Christians in the occupied territories emigrate three or four times as fast, are emigrating three or four times as fast as the Muslims. We have a tiny minority, it's down to 4 or 5% of, if you like, the original Christians, because they have, I think, the strongest claim to say that they are the descendants of Jesus' disciples on the spot. There's been a church there since he was there, basically, among the Gentiles. And they are disappearing fast. And in Jerusalem, for example, there were 47,000 Christians in 1947, 48, when Israel was established. Today there are about 10,000. So we're going to have a holy land that's really going to be a museum soon. There won't be any living stones to see. So those are some of the consequences that make this kind of a heavy topic, even though it's fun to see Indiana Jones shoot the guy with the sword, you know. But that's all part of our rather one-sided interaction, I think, with the region. We need to fight for some of those people that he's killing off so easily, because they won't be there. Yeah.
And watching the images on the first film, I was intrigued by turning it around and saying, how then could we similarly make pictures depicting the negative side of all that the United States of America is? And it would be very, very easy to do. And instead of a chuckle here and there, when those images were shown, if they were turned around and we saw it from the other side of the mirror, how uncomfortable we would be, and how easy I know it would be to do that.
Another thing which is sort of related there is that Middle Easterners, they watch the same stuff. They watch Lawrence of Arabia, Exodus. They like them. You know, they watch all this stuff. They watch CNN. The people being bombed watch the bombers broadcasting about the bombing. You know, and they get the same image. That's where media comes into so much trouble for us now, because I think you see evidence of it when you. It's happened to me quite a few times in personal conversations with Middle Easterners. They say terrible things about their region. Things that are obviously not true, things that are as prejudiced as you and I might be. And I think part of it is that they believe this the way we believe it. They believe that they're, that, and they have, let's remind ourselves, stereotypes have base in fact. I mean, they're sort of devices to sort out reality, aren't they? And there are crazy Arabs, of course there are, but they're also crazy. Us, there are incompetent, terrible rulers, but we got a few of those too. You know, we don't have to go overseas to find those. So we just don't need any part of it if we're serious about relationships with that part of the world. Yes.
Realistically, how are Christians treated in Israel?
By the Israelis, you mean, or by the Muslims?
No. By the Israelis, by. Israeli people, by the government, by what the way they have to live.
Well, they get basically treated like the rest of the Palestinians. They get a little extra attention because they have links to the West, which make them a little more dangerous. And it's been one of the big fights of the churches in East Jerusalem, for example, to call out to their sisters and brothers in the West and say, remember us, you know, work for peace, don't let all this stuff go on. Push for some of these UN resolutions about us to be implemented the way you did it so fast in Iraq, you know, and Kuwait. We got a few resolutions that are 50 years old, you know, what's wrong with them? So the Christians have been, Hanan Ashrawi is a Christian, you know, the spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation, the one who's broken a few images, I think, for a lot of us. In her, as a woman, as an articulate English-speaking, you know, educated Arab, they are treated also perhaps a little extra badly because they have, by and large, a little bit higher socioeconomic status, so they have more to lose. I mean, the tourist industry, for example, in East Jerusalem, naturally enough, the Arabs in the Holy Land business themselves were Christians, by and large. And they've been run out of business, basically. There are hotels in East Jerusalem that are just derelicts, I mean, and they're owned by Christians. They're just sitting there. They haven't had enough business because we're scared to go there. Or there's been trouble. It's hard to say whether
they're... Is it fair to say that Christians in Israel are a persecuted minority?
As Palestinians, first. Not as Christians so much. But... yeah, I think that's just the best thing to say. There are very few Israeli Christians, or what do they call them, Jewish believers or something like that. those to talk about. There's maybe 2,000. There's a few groups that have ministries to those people to try to convert the Jews, but there's very few people like that. And then the Arab Christian Palestinians living in Israel proper, again, they're part of the Arab situation. Yeah?
I think you need to clarify that you said that half of the Christian population lives in the West Bank and in occupied territories, and that half lives
in Israel. Israel proper.
And the thing is, if they live in Israel and they're Israeli citizens, like there are Israeli Arabs or Israeli Palestinians, they're treated completely different than those in the territory. And they have right to vote and the same rights as citizens. And any Israeli citizen, whether they're Jewish or
Yeah, but if you go to an Arab village, it doesn't look like an Israeli village in Israel proper. There aren't curbs. There aren't new houses.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, they don't feel, the ones I've talked to don't feel quite so strongly about it. And by the way, I got to put in a plug for the book that's in the bookstore. It's called Blood Brothers. And the reason I think of it is because he's an Arab Israeli. His name's Elias Shakur, and he tells his life story. And the way to get around this stuff, and you know, the bottom line in this seminar is to get to know people themselves. Get to know an Arab American if you can't go and get to know an Arab in the Middle East. And one of the ways to do that without even meeting anybody is to go and read some of these people's stories.